Motopod, proudly supported by Roadskin, a UK label specializing in protective outerwear for motorcyclists. Modern biker clothing that you can wear all day long and engineered to save your skin. For the road, for life, visit roadskin.co.uk. To Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 781 for September 24th, 2024. A lot of fours in there, Rich. Rich is with us again this week, people. He's not anywhere. I was on Busman's holiday for a while, but I did get the racing watch wrist, if you noticed, because I'm ready to go here. It was a really full weekend of racing for me.
Yes, I
was off at Indianapolis for the IMSA race. It was a six-hour race there. So I spent some time with the buds, my mates, if you will. Good way to relax. It was kind of, it's different racing that I like. I like cars. I like that kind of car racing most of all. I think I've got to the point where I'm not really a Formula One fan anymore, but I'd much rather watch endurance racing. So it was a 6 hour event at it, which is ironic because like I went and saw the 6 hour at Watkins Glen and it was, the heat index was 106 and it was like 98 or 99 degrees there in New York in June. And it's like, oh, I'm going to go to Indy, right? Go to Indy. It's 98 degrees at Indianapolis in late September, autumnal summer. And I still deal with 98 degree heat at a 6 hour race. Anyway, it rained on Sunday, which made it really interesting. But anyway, we're not talking about cars. That's it. Enough of that, Rich. No more talk. No more car talk. No more car talk. But Rich, I would like you to Yes. I would like you to give a shout out to all the people who are helping the show out, if you would, sir.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you very much indeed. So with the PayPal subscribers, we've got Gareth Locke, Jacob Nurkow, Carl Hun, Rick Taylor, Nori Ito, Nick Saban, and Alan Fleming. And then our friends on Patreon include Michael Cowan, Brenton Edwards, Scott Baldwin, Ollie, Dennis Kindig, Jeremy Burnich, Jacob Rower, Darren Andrews, Paul Lang, Gary Shavit, and Steve. So it's quite a nice long list. It has grown a little bit as we've reported over recent episodes. Always keen to have some more financial subscribers contributing to the show. And as I said, either in the World Superbike interview show that I put out the other day or the intro that I've just recorded for the next one that will be out after this show, we definitely want to go down this road of encouraging the patrons and the PayPal subscribers to fire in questions so that when either you or I or anybody else in the future from a Motopod go to these events and we have interviews lined up with the superstars in World Superbikes and MotoGP, et cetera, that we can field questions from the listeners as a little perk of being a regular subscriber to the show. So, yeah, thank you, everybody. Much appreciated. If anybody else can drop a few coins in the tin each month, that would be highly appreciated. There we go, Jim.
All right. Appreciate that, Rich. Appreciate everybody who is subscribe to the show or who is donating to the show as well. So with that, let's go right to the news, Rich. I think we'll go there. So the worst kept secret in all of MotoGP, the coveted last spot on the Pramac Yamaha team, is gone officially to Jack Miller. We knew Jack was going to be the guy on the list. We'd known it for weeks and he finally got there. I think Miller's lucky for this lifeline. I think this is like the last hurrah for Miller. Do you agree?
I do, and especially given that it's a one-year contract as well. So I guess both sides maybe are just feeling this one out a little bit. I suspect Yamaha more so than Jack. I mean, Jack, as far as we knew, was out of the series for next year. So this isn't a lifeline for him. As we've said, we don't need to repeat it too much. For me, still a bit of a curious choice to take Oliveira and Miller, but anyway, that's what's happening. So, yeah, good to have Jack still in the series. He's a great personality and everybody loves him, so that's a positive, I guess. But yeah, still think it's a bit of an odd choice.
I agree. So here, the next bit is that Yamaha have admitted they have a development of a V4. Now, is this the end of the inline four, or will the new 850 rules and removal of the shapeshifters and electronics make the inline engine viable once more? Interesting question, Rich. I'll give you my thoughts here first.
Yeah, interested to hear.
You have to believe at some point that Yamaha was going to have to get to the V4. It's sort of now been defined as the proper engine to have, mainly because everybody's revving these things to the moon now, and they're trying to pull as much horsepower out of them. And aerodynamics are also a huge effect on the motorcycle now. So having a very wide front aero, how do I say, with the inline four, you have to have a wider bike, right? You can't build it as narrow. You've got you have exact number of crank journals and things that you could have, and when you crank bearings and stuff. And when you do that, you're going to be wide. So that means it's a big frontal area, which is what I was looking for. Aerodynamically, it's a big frontal area that you're trying to push all this air through the radiator, through the oil cooler, all that kind of stuff. And it may not be the most effective motor for that particular part of it. First heard there was this Yamaha have admitted we're developing a V4, my first thought was, hey, we're going to go down that path for 850, which makes sense, right? You've got the time to develop now, to develop your 850, and then take that. Now, given that you're going to make an 850 probably just because of the size of each particular cylinder bore is going to become smaller, it's conceivable that Yamaha would want to build an inline motor, which because they could then make it smaller. Now, who knows what they may or may not do, right? But it seems to me like they're just headed that way. And I just think the 850 is going to be a V4 Yamaha. That doesn't mean it's going to happen, but I mean, I can understand why they're doing it.
Fair enough. I mean, I don't have the technical knowledge, I guess, when all things are said and done. I just like watching them going around in circles really, really quickly. But so I'm pinching this from, I think it was David Emmett. I was listening to or reading a couple of things from, and he was making the point that with the aero being, air quotes, restricted, and we don't really quite know how this is going to work in practice, of course, but you know, as you just pointed out, Jim, frontal areas, weight distributions are going to change significantly under the new rule set. So it might well be that a V4 is or isn't, and ditto an inline four, is or isn't a good configuration to go along with the fact that you're going to have different frames for different motors, less or different aero, no shapeshifters to confuse matters. So it is going to be fundamentally different. And he also made a very salient point, which is that if Yamaha do introduce this V4, as early as next year, potentially, because it's on the test bench already, they're going to have a different frame and a completely new setup for that as well. So it goes to show just how much effort and money, more to the point as well, Yamaha are throwing at improving their performance. And you can already see, certainly in terms of the races last weekend, or weekend just gone, with Cutraro, had a pretty good weekend. So the package is not completely done yet, although the V4 clearly in this formula is the one to have. So yeah, just an interesting development, because many people, and I think including myself, probably thought that Yamaha would never move away from the inline four. And they may conclude that they still won't, but they clearly do have a development engine on the bench, you know, and they're checking it out.
So just thinking this through a little bit more for me, you know, you got to think, you know, Yamaha had V4 500 two-strokes. So they know how to build a V engine. I can't think of any road bike of Yamaha's that had a V in it. There's the V Max, which was a V twin, and it was a V4. And it's not without precedent that Yamaha hasn't had V engined motorcycles, right? They're sort of known for the inline four, but it's not without precedent that they could make one of those. Now, what's really could be interesting is what do they want to do with their Pramac team? Do they give them an 850cc inline four and two bikes to do a development direction sort of that way? And do they have a V4 that Pramac gets and they do development for Quattroaro? Or do they split it one and one, which would be completely crazy considering the, like you said, the frame, or Dave Emmett said, the frame's got to be completely different. But, sometimes if you got to make a completely different frame for a motor, and let's assume that Yamaha, all four of the bikes that Pramac get are all going to be a V4 next year. Let's just assume that for this argument. You build a chassis, you're going to make bigger gains faster with that new chassis than you are with anything else, because you've kind of done figured out every combination that may exist there with your chassis, because you've ran that chassis for so long that you may know everything about it. And it's that, I don't know if this is the right term, so Jacob Brawler might be mad at me, but it's kind of like going to be like a serendipitous thing that you find having a new chassis, because you're doing different things and you happen to stumble upon this magical ingredient, you as it were, and you suddenly become very fast. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where if you look at the rule book, I think you almost got to believe that that's the way to go, because everybody's kind of taking that form. Now, is it going to be a 90 degree V4 like Ducati's? Is it going to be the 88, or like the L motors, if you will, like Ducati, right? With one cylinder basically almost horizontal out front. Is it going to be the truly V 90 V like a Honda? Is it going to be 88 in some change like KTM have? Is it going to be like Aprilia's, right? You don't really know, but you can definitely build a bike that's well balanced with a V4 for sure. I
Yeah.
don't know.
I mean,
It's
the risk
really
that they've
interesting.
got, Jim, the risk that they've got is, it's a well-trodden phrase, but we have heard, how long have we heard, the Yamaha is the sweetest handling bike out there. It's the corner speed bike. It's the one that likes the corners the most. The risk that they've got, I think, is that they solve the engine problem, but then they lose their way in terms of a completely radically different chassis, different handling. And do they lose that particular sweet spot that they've got? So, it's a road strewn with peril, really, I think, for Yamaha, because they're going so far away from what they've known for so long that that won't be an easy transition. Just on your point about what Pramac run, I'm not sure if homologation rules on the engine would allow them to do something like that as a single manufacturer.
Yeah,
I
I don't
suspect
know.
they wouldn't have that option. Don't know. I mean, could be wrong on that, but I suspect the technical rules and the financial constraints around the technical rules might prohibit that.
Yeah, but it was just a thought. It was just like,
We'll see.
if I'm doing that, I which way do I want to go, kind of thing.
Oh, let's
this.
be honest, all of the manufacturers would do whatever they could get away with.
Oh.
It's only the rules and the financial constraints that stop them from getting
Yeah.
into an arms race on
Oh,
money,
yeah.
which is what the rules were designed to stop.
Yeah, definitely. Let's see. Next item of note. India off the 2025 calendar already. I did not see where they were off the calendar. I think you know more than on this one, Rich. So I'm gonna take the lead on
Well,
this one.
yeah, only insofar as I saw a tweet coming out, and I think it was crash.net, so a reputable source indicating that the problems are already starting to rear their head again with regards to the Indian round, and I suspect that won't be the only one. There are a couple of other races on the calendar which I think are probably quite likely to remain troublesome in terms of whether they can go ahead or not. So I don't think it would be a big surprise if India does not appear on the actual list next year, even though it's on the provisional one. And clearly there is a news article going around at the minute that, yeah, there are still problems. I mean, our understanding from just again hearing it on the sort of the wind is that money has never been paid by the organizers of that race to pay the sanctioning fee to run it. So this is a money game at the end of the day. So if the cash doesn't show up, then the event doesn't happen. So I suspect that will continue to be the case. So I feel very sorry for the fans in India, because I think the first race there, the one and only race that we've had, was quite well attended and went down very well, other than the stifling heat, which was a problem for the riders and the teams. I think it was a very good event, and I feel for the fans out there that probably won't get to see, the bikes again, which is a shame for them.
Yeah.
And it's a very important market as well.
Very. So, speaking of the calendar, Hungary is supposed to be on the calendar 2025. Now, it's not the Hungaroring where like Formula One goes, oh gosh, car reference. Sorry, folks. But it's the other, what's the track called? Can't think of the name of it off the top of my head. I had it for a minute, but I lost it. Anyway, that has
It
to
begins with
go
B, doesn't it? Is it the Baltan Ring or something like that?
something. But either way, that track has
I'll
a
look it up.
huge amount of infrastructure that has to be changed to bring it up to the grade, FIA grade, for the racing that's there. So then if you believe that Brno is on the calendar, if you believe that Argentina is on the calendar, if you believe Kazakhstan's on the calendar, if you believe Hungary's on the calendar and India's on the calendar, there's three races right there, as Simon Patterson said, that are in no way, shape, or form probably going to happen. Argentina is not going to happen. Kazakhstan's not going to happen. And more than likely, Hungary's not going to happen because I don't know how they could make all the changes required of that track to make it possible for, the bikes to go there. I mean, it's supposed to be there for, it's on the World Superbike calendar and it's also on the MotoGP calendar, which will be really interesting because it's like the first time that, well, I can't think of, like, I know that Super Bowl, World Superbike goes to like Jerez or whatever, but you have another track where you can compare the difference between things. And there is kind of a big straightaway, long straightaway on that circuit. So it'd be interesting to see kind of where the lap times fall out between Superbikes and MotoGP bikes there. But yeah, not too sure what's going to happen there.
I'm just looking. It's the Balaton Park is
Okay.
the name of the track, I believe. Interestingly, just one thing, and I do need to dig into this a little further, Jim, but we were talking about Manicor and the in relation to the accident that Toprak had there a few weeks back.
Yeah.
Subsequently, I was listening to something else, and I say I might be getting the facts slightly askew here, but they were talking about a kind of ABC designation that a track has. Only A designation tracks will accept or can host MotoGP, whereas World Superbike run at some more, if you like, B category tracks. So that's
Correct.
why World Supers run at Manicor, for example, and not MotoGP. So I guess Balaton Park in Hungary must meet the criteria for both. But again, other events have been cancelled in Hungary because, politically, without wanting to stray into dodgy area, but politically, it's a bit of a tricky place to go as well currently. So I don't know if that's fed into some of the problems there. But as you say, it's on the calendar. So, but again, I would suspect it's one with a fairly large question mark against it as things stand just at the moment.
Yeah, I was looking at it more from the standpoint of what, for the angle Simon Patterson was going down. There has to be some upgrades for the MotoGP bikes. Now, do they have to have it for World Superbikes? No. So there is a possibility they could still remain on the World Superbike calendar, but they may not have the A grade required to get MotoGP bikes there. But either way, it's going to be interesting to figure out where we're going. I don't care. As long as we go back to Brno, I'm happy. Let's just say it that way.
Absolutely.
So the next item on the list here is the new Michelin front has been delayed yet again and will not arrive until 2026. What's the reason for it this time, Rich? Because I haven't read this one. I don't know the full details behind it. It seems weird because they had such a test and everybody seemed to think it was a good tire. Bagnaia thought it was reminiscent of a Bridgestone, near uncrashable. So I'm like, what is it, a production issue? What's the deal?
My understanding is that I just don't think Michelin are ready with it. They haven't got enough data with it. The testing on that tire, okay, they did do some testing at Misano, it's true, but that has been about, I think, the only time that they have tested it. And as Simon Patterson pointed out on the race podcast this week, which many people will have heard him say, this really lies squarely with the organizers who could, for example, be mandating that people use it in free practice one on a Friday morning, which is a bit of a throwaway session often anyway. And if everybody was running it, then there wouldn't nobody would be disadvantaged particularly. And then they'd start the business of the weekend proper from practice two on the current tire. Because the problem we've got now that it's delayed again, this is a tire that's designed for the current set of regulations in terms of the aero and the shape shifting and all the rest of it, which is causing, depending on your point of view, causing so much trouble with the racing. If it's delayed till 2026, and who's to say that won't slip
Double A
again?
again,
It's only got a year, and then it's potentially not. I mean, okay, you may still use it because
I
it's
think they
giving more
would
grip,
continue down
but
that
under the new
path, yeah.
regs, that might. Yeah, but it might require a different sort of tire once the 850s arrive on the scene. So, at the rate they're going, it's not going to be of any use to have it. And in the meantime, we're left with a front tire that most people think is not suitable a lot of the time. So it's just very frustrating because this is an avoidable problem, or was an avoidable problem. Arguably, it's not really solvable now. So just a shame. But yeah, again, sorry to be the harbour of bad news, but.
It's all right. I gotta believe that at some point they have to mandate that people they either limit a test at Sepang, or they limit the testing at the other tracks that we're gonna go to in the winter, and they dedicate an hour of time, and everybody's gotta go use that tire. It's the only way we're gonna get one, and I think we need one. I think we agree. I mean, the racing has been good. I'm not gonna lie, but there are some races it's not. And it's if you can build a tire, then let's have the right tire. Again, this is kind of odd to me because Bridgestone is it's weird. Michelin's like this. Their deal with tires is like black magic, right? Like it doesn't seem like there's like an engineering idea of like, well, we're gonna put a tire together that does this, and it's gonna do work. And it's like, oh no, we just feel we want to use some of this, and we want to sprinkle some of that on it, and da, da, da. And suddenly they come up with a recipe that works, and then they sort of copy it. Bridgestone, when they were there, is like there's all kinds of things that they were doing that they knew exactly what it should do in some way or form. There was a very, engineering. We always talk about what's called design of experiments, right? I'm trying to figure out what affects the other thing, and can I correct that thing by isolating out the parameters that are in there, and you solve yourself down to this solution. It seems like Bridgestone was very good at that, at least in my opinion, they were. And then Michelin just sort of like, yeah, well, yeah, it's, kind of here. I don't see how you, I mean, as good as their tires are in oh gosh, car racing, that's, they, especially endurance racing, you think that there would be that. But I mean, there's what, is Michelin involved in World Endurance, or is that a Pirelli dominated thing? Can't rem I don't know if it is or isn't.
Pass. Don't know.
I know it was like
Don't know if
Suzuka,
they
and
even
they've
got a
got
control
many
tire in.
different tires there, because some people got Dunlop, some people got Bridgestone, some people have Michelin and whatnot. So I don't know. Anyhow,
I don't know.
yeah.
I feel for the tire manufacturers because in a way they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't. And you can perfectly well understand why Michelin want to have a tire that they're 100% confident in before they let people out on it, because the minute you start having failures or underperformance, who gets lambasted for it is the tire manufacturer. So we saw this on Sunday with Bagnaia in his rear. So it's an extraordinarily difficult position to be in. But on the other hand, I mean, they tendered for the bleeding contract and they obviously wanted to win it. So that's careful what you wish for. But yeah, just a shame that tires will continue to be a talking point and an issue, around this issue of tire pressures and overheating, and yeah, just a bit boring really to have, sort of have to keep returning to it. But that's the news, so that's what it is.
Okay. Also, from the Misano test, there were trials of pit to rider radio. Your thoughts on this first, Rich, before mine?
I'm deadly against this on for a whole host of different reasons. I don't know what's driving it. I think it might be being pushed under the auspices of safety. I think that would be a misnomer when it comes to motorcycle racing. I mean, as several people have already pointed out, you had Jorge Martin at the first Misano race getting distracted by a message that came up on his screen, let alone somebody screaming something in his ear. I just don't think it has any place. There are all sorts of issues around hardware going into helmets that aren't really designed for that kind of use. What happens in a big crash if you've got other equipment inside a helmet? If race control are using it and they want to use it for notifying yellow flags or incidents on a track, how does that work? Does everybody hear it, even though somebody might be on the other side of the track? There are so many operational and safety issues around this. And the cynic in me kind of thinks that this might be getting driven from a kind of desire to have a drive to survive kind of deal going on with the riders. during the races and stuff. And I can't think of anything worse than hearing riders whinging and moaning and telling on each other. I mean, it's become an epidemic of mediocrity in terms of the behavior in Formula One, with pits to car radio. And I just don't think we want to see, or more to the point here, any of that in bike racing. So I'm vehemently opposed to it on just about every metric you could measure. So yeah, I think my position on this one's fairly clear, Jim, but interested to know if you differ.
I do slightly. I in no way want to hear any kind of winching and tattletaling on another rider. I have no place for that at all with this. I am of the opinion that having someone say something in your ear is less distracting than a dash light or my attention being brought to my dash to read something that's been put there. Because to read it requires me to focus there as opposed to keep my eyes on the road as I'm going 150 miles an hour. If they use it, I would hope that it is only one person's voice. It is that of a race control individual. And I would hope that it would be something to the effect of that they could send out a signal to a specific rider. Like I'm sure everything would be on a specific frequency. So if you were to receive a long lap penalty, that you would be told by race control in your ear and not anybody else's that you have a long lap penalty that you have to take. If thinking of it from a safety standpoint, if there was a yellow in a certain sector, it could be used to alert all riders that in sector two, there's a yellow, something to that effect. I don't have a problem with that. However, it is as with all things that are of a good intention, it will get misaligned and confused, and it will be used for things that it wasn't used for, and people will figure out some way to cheat it and all that kind of stuff. I do think that if you do have it, I mean, most of the Formula One guys, I'm not 100% certain how much equipment is truly in their helmets. I always have believed that their earplugs were made with a speaker in them, so that the only thing that they had basically was a mic that was in the chin bar of the helmet, which wouldn't be extremely difficult. But then again, I don't want to have riders winching about things. So if it was just some earbuds, essentially, that ran down, your suit plugged into, say, the hump in the back where the accelerometers and things are for your airbag in it, I don't have a problem with it. But it's a very specific use case for me.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I mean, I personally, when you see a lot of the stuff that flashes up on the screens, okay, admittedly, some of that is coming from the teams themselves, i.e.,
Sure.
rider such and such, rider such and such is in front of you. It's like, yeah, duh, they can see it. But why do you need a message to tell you that? I mean, some of the stuff is really banal beyond belief. And as you say, these things, you get mission creep with these things. And as you say, they start to get used to stuff that was never part of the original intention. And again, I am sort of a 52-year-old cynic. With Liberty potentially coming on board, or probably coming on board, you can kind of sense that they would want to sex the show up, to use an unpleasant but often used phrase. And that would be one area where they could try and create a bit more kind of, yeah, TV friendly content, I suppose, in terms of the personalities. I'm not the only person that said this, having been along to a few races. These riders are not sort of overdoing it when it comes to some of their media commitments. So, I think, as I think I tweeted the other day on this particular issue, the riders could be made to work a bit harder off the bikes in terms of the public facing aspects of them, and the, developing the personalities and making more of some of that stuff before you need to start having, live chat. If it was restricted purely to race, safety critical race control calls in the manner that you're describing, Jim, okay, maybe. But even there, I think there are some issues with that in terms of how it would actually work. But I'm yeah, interested to know what the listeners think on this one, because it's going to be a proper Marmite kind of issue, this one. It'll be a love it, hate it kind of thing. Some people will potentially like the razzmatazz of it if you went full kind of discussing tactics. But I mean, for me, again, I'm old fashioned, I'm a purist. The pit board should be enough. That's how it worked for a long, long time. I don't really see why we need to change it.
Agreed on that one. Bobben Schneider and his team. What I pronounce that one for me, Rich, because there's a lot of vowels in there for me on that one. Is it the
I
Precanos?
think it's Pricanus,
Perconus?
yeah, something like. It's a strange spelling, isn't it? I must
Yeah,
admit, I
it
haven't
is.
happened across it before. So when I was looking at it, I was thinking, "Oh, blimey, how are we going to manage that?" I think it's
Yeah.
Pricanus, yeah.
Though he has left the team and they parted ways with the team. And what was, if you saw the press release, was an absolutely unedifying dressing down of a writer. It was, let's just air all the dirty laundry and put it out in a press release kind of a thing. Like,
Shocking,
whew.
yeah.
Yeah, it's like, wow. I mean, whew. That was just really kind of crazy. And then they sort of continued with that when they were, when the, I think it was the owner was talking to about it to was it to Jack Applegate, I think. It was laid out that, like, well, you know, hey, you got to perform. And you know, it's always, well, tomorrow, 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 tomorrow. Well, tomorrow never got there. And we're tired of languishing down the grid, if you will. And it's like, wow, that's, I mean, I'd much rather just had a press release that said, hey, we've parted company. You know, that would be much a better way to put it, because you know, and the thing of it is, like, if you read the press release too, what really kind of confused me was they talked about how, like, you know, you're always welcome back when you get your stuff together. And I'm like, and we believe
Yeah,
in you. So it's
it was
like, okay,
bizarre.
I'm gonna
Just
dress
really
you
bizarre.
down. Yeah, I'm gonna dress you down, I'm gonna yell at you, I'm gonna tell everybody that you pretty much you suck. And then I'm gonna say, well, by the way, if you ever get your act together, come on back again. I was like, you do that, I don't think anybody wins. Because who's gonna want to go ride for you? I mean, okay, somebody's going to, but that's, I mean, but that, it just hold, the whole thing is just wild in my opinion. It's like, oof, but hey, that's what happens, I guess.
The whole chronology of it, Jim, I don't quite know. So we mustn't stray into areas where I'm telling stuff that is, not true. My understanding, though, is that Ben Schneider was kind of running his mouth off about areas of the team and the bike that he was dissatisfied with. And that's not unusual. I mean, riders are always wanting more and they're quite critical. They're, alphas and they're highly competitive and all the rest of it. So they want the best. And Ben Schneider has not had a good season and a half, couple of seasons. I seem to recall him being quite good when he first arrived into Moto2. So things have clearly gone wrong. But as you say, Jim, normally the kind of political party line is, both parties have mutually agreed to part ways, and each side will wish each other the best, and off they go. Whereas this was a kind of an extraordinary war of words, really, and yeah, very kind of unpleasant, really, in tone. So just a bit bizarre. That's, I normally wouldn't really have mentioned it in the news, but it was just those emails with the press releases coming out. I was reading this stuff and thinking, flipping heck, this is really, I mean, when it goes wrong, it really goes wrong. And that one certainly did. So it was just noteworthy. So if anybody can figure out the spelling and the pronunciation of the team, go and find their press releases and have give yourself a few minutes of amusement. Although, I mean, not good that the team have falling out and the rider falling out in quite such a spectacular fashion. But yes, I mean, from a spectating point of view, reading this stuff, it's quite illuminating.
So, World Superbike, we'll move into World Superbike, is what I should say. Is that the Cremona circuit where they were last weekend? And Aragon is this weekend. Is Toprak going to be back or not after that very scary incident in Magny-Cours?
Obviously, the intention was for him to be back for Cremona, but I think probably a lot of people felt that that was a little bit ambitious. So, in the end, a few days before the Cremona event, which is in Italy, by the way, it was announced that he was going to stay put in. I think he's in Austria at the Red Bull High Performance Institute, where they take all their top sports people. So, he's recuperating there. I mean, in terms of just very briefly, I don't want to spend too much time on this. First race at Cremona, very sort of short, tight slightly nadgery track, but the racing was actually very good. And I mean, the big takeaway of the weekend was that Danilo Petrucci won his first World Superbike race, and then his second, and then his third. So he did the treble, and he's, I think they said, the only the 18th rider to win in a MotoGP race and a World Superbike race as well. So that's quite an accolade, as well as, you know, the other stuff that he's done
But
in
think
other
about it.
series
He's
and, you know, on the Dakar, of course, won a stage.
right. He's the only rider to be able to win at MotoGP, at World Superbike, at Moto America, and then a stage of the Dakar Rally, which is pretty phenomenal for the guy. It's amazing, quite honestly.
Even more so, given that he was in a hospital bed, you know, from everything that I've read and heard about it, pretty close to, you know, not where you want to
Dying.
be, having had a huge motocross accident earlier in the season. Most people thought, myself included, that he came back a bit too early. So, but I mean, like all these guys, are just, yeah, just incredible the way they can recover and push on through the pain. But yeah, so to see him do the treble in Italy, of all places, as well, just to, you know, put an extra cherry on top of the cake was amazing, really. And the significance of it was, though, was that it prevented Nico Bouliger from maximizing the points, because had Bouliger won all three races, he would now be leading the championship, whereas he's 13 points behind Toprak. So it's very, very close again. And a bit like MotoGP, World Superbike is now very busy in these last few rounds. So they're coming thick and fast, which is obviously not ideal for Toprak given his injury position. But I suspect he will be back at Aragon given how close the points are now. As to how well he's going to do and how he's going to fare, obviously we'll find out if that is what happens. As of just becoming, before we came on to recording this, Jim, there was nothing I could see online saying he is or isn't going to be riding at Aragon. So that one, I guess, we'll find out in a day or two's time. But yeah, so that's kind of World Superbike. The only other thing to mention, I was talking about young Ryan Vickers in BSB the other day. I was, you know, he spectacularly sort of crashed out of the lead. And had a bit of a rotten weekend at Cadwell Park a few weeks ago. Well, he's actually, it was announced that one of the guys in Supersport, I think it is coming up to that OMG Yamaha team next year. So everybody's thinking, oh, they've sacked Ryan Vickers, but it actually transpires that Vickers has signed a deal to go to m race on the Moto Corsa Ducati in World Superbike. So he'll be replacing Michael Ruben Rinaldi in that squad. So yeah, fair play, Ryan. He's going up to world levels. So as a lot of Brits do, of course, from BSB into World Superbike. So he's very, very, very fast, but he is a little prone to pushing a bit too hard. So we'll see. Fair play to him. Not many people get to ride in World Superbike, so that's a great move for him. And then just on BSB, very, very briefly, yeah, we've got Donington Park this weekend. So that's the penultimate round of BSB. And I was waxing lyrical with you last show, Jim, about the point scoring system. I did have it wrong. So just to clarify, I looked up the rules, and for the main part of the season, up till the final three rounds, the scoring has been top 15 score as is normal, but the winner was only getting 18 and then second for 16. So you can see what this does. It keeps the points table very close through the sort of two thirds of the season. And then for what are actually rounds 9 and 10, round 10 being the penultimate round, you're then scoring 25 for a win and 22. So you start to get slightly bigger gaps in the point scoring. And then for Brands Hatch, which will be the final round, round 11, there you will be scoring 35 for the win. And bearing in mind, there's three races each round as well. So there's lots of points to score here. So that's how they've constructed the points table, just to give it a bit more detail. If you Google BSB point scoring system 2024, you can go and read it for yourself. So that's how they tinkered with the sort of the showdown format. And I know you were quite positive towards this in terms of producing a bit of jeopardy, an incentive, and allowing other people that were there or thereabouts to catch up a bit, you know, in these last vital three rounds and nine races as it is. So yeah, that's the detail anyway.
Cool. That wraps up all of the news. That puts us into the second Mezzano race. And we'll start out with Moto 3, as we usually do. Now, one of the things that about this one was that what Thursday it rained, or Wednesday, Thursday it rained at Mezzano. And what part of the track was underwater? I mean, it just apparently bucketed down. So,
Torrential,
yeah. So all the bugs were out because, I mean, any view you saw What it reminded me of literally was the TT with all of the gnats or whatever they have there that lie under the trees as the sun tends to go down, because they sort of race a lot of those races on a week night, and they you know, everybody gets home from work, if you will, and then they, you know, go through there. It was funny. I mean, you could tell it was bad because if you looked at most of the riders, they had tear off nubs on each side of their helmet, both left and right. And generally, you don't do that. It's because you only want your right hand or whatever, because you can, you know, reach across or whatever to pull one. But I was shocked with all the bugs. But that's neither here nor there. If we looked at Moto3 from a qualifying one, Rueda was in qualifying one, which kind of surprised me. After having had a win and everything, he was back to sort of the standard Rueda, which is I can't go fast enough to be able to be out of this situation. He was joined by Rossi, Furosato, Carraro, Rolston. I think those are some of the guys that we're kind of used to seeing in here, but Rueda is sort of that standout there. But he did go through. He was quickest. Almanza, Furosato, and Ogden all went through to the qualifying too. When we got to qualifying two, halfway through, Alonso was the quickest, followed by Ortola, Furosato, Piqueras, Adrian Fernandez, Rueda, and Holgado. Vire was 10th, and I thought, well, Vire's going to put one hot lap in here. But Ogden was down, which created a yellow sector, and it was 30 seconds to go on the time when that happened. I didn't know where everybody was going to fill out because it was really hard to figure out who was or was not in the right area so they could get a clean lap. Alonso had a golden lap going, but he wound up falling as well. But Furosato took his first pole, a blistering lap he did. Alonso was still quick enough to be second, but Piqueras was third. Then Ortola, Nepa, Vire, who, you know, jumped up four places there. Then Fernandez, Adrian, Munoz, Rueda, and Joel Kelso in the top 10. This time having gone directly to Q2 as opposed to having to go through Q1 via his own volition. So,
Deliberately, yeah.
yeah, you know, things were looking fairly well there as we got into the race on Sunday. Now, at the beginning of the race, we knew that Munoz would get a double long lap penalty for the irresponsible riding from the previous race that we had. So, okay, cool. So, green flag, start, second turn, Munoz is down. He tagged the rear of another rider. I think it might have been Alonso that he tagged. He did tag someone there. It was a blue bike, that much I had. I wasn't sure exactly who it actually was. But he was down. He would remount. He basically ran enough laps, did his two long lap penalties, so he doesn't have to carry that again through. But first auto was out front with Alonso and Ortola, Piqueras, Vire, and Nepo and Holgado. Alonso would jump to lead and hold that for a little bit at the end of that first lap. But it gets to this race where literally Holgado, Piqueras, Fernandez, Furosato, Alonso, Vire are all at the front, and they're all in some order of what's going on. Alonso's kind of doing his Alonso thing. He's in that 4-5 spot. Furosato kind of goes rushing through the pack and takes the lead for a little bit, but it gets like a track limits warning. Like, okay, that's, you know, he still had a good, you know, 20 lap race. He still had, it was a lap 14 that he did it on. He still had, you know, 12, 13 laps left. So you're expecting a track limits warning there. Nepa's got a track limits warning. Piqueras was nearly down from a massive front end slide that he had. It had at the, I think it was the last turn on the track. He, you know, leg off the whole nine yards there. Alonso had got himself back to lead, but anytime he did, Hogarda retaliated. And then Furosato just dive bombed Adrian Fernandez. And I'm going, why on earth was he doing that? They were all together in the pack in front. There was no reason to dive bomb Adrian Fernandez. He could have, you know, that move could have came a lap later or two laps later. But I believe, if I'm correct in saying this, that Furosato got a long lap penalty for the irresponsible riding of that incident, which is a shame. Anyway, things kind of at this point settle down for about 5-6 laps. It's a really calm Moto3 race. Everybody's just kind of like, pretty much had decided, like, look, we've beat each other up for 12 and a half, 13 laps here. Nobody's getting away from each other. So let's just cool it for a second and let's just go to the end and settle this like men. for lack of anything better to say. So they kind of just tool around until we get to like the four laps to go. Four to go. Alonso's out front, Helgado, Piqueras, and Vire. Then there's one over like 1.1 seconds to Ortola. Because Ortola was trying to get from the bad start he had, try to work his way up. But could he actually get there? And then everything holds station for the third lap. And then with two to go, chaos breaks
All hell
out.
Breaks loose.
All hell breaks yeah. loose. All hell breaks. Holgado dives by Alonso. Then Piqueras came through because that pushed both them wide. And then Alonso goes back by. And then Piqueras goes by. Holgado goes by. They swap back. They swap forth. They go this way. They go that way. It's an incredible race. You can't really take any kind of a note. But at the very end, it finally works itself out to where Alonso wins this crazy clash of titans. And then Piqueras was second, followed by Holgado and Vire, who got on the podium. Then it was Holgado, Ortola, Lunetta for your top six. Kelso had a seventh. Then Fernandez, Bertoli, Rueda, Suzuki, Feroli for a Sato after his long lap penalty. Nepa, and then your last finisher was Yamanaka at 15. An absolutely amazing race that just kind of was crazy at the beginning, settled down, and then just became this purely chaotic, pass you, pass me, back forth, run over the curbs. It was just, you know, it was typical Moto 3. It's what you love. It's what you live for within one of these races. It wasn't quite the cracking race we had last time at Misano where, you know, Piqueras comes from the too long lap penalty to win at the very end as a surprise. You knew the guys who were going to be there were going to be there. And thank God Alonso won, because that two race losing streak of not winning is just terrible for that kid. I mean, I don't know. Let's throw him away. Let's not even give him a Moto 2 ride. I mean, the kid's just obviously unworthy given that lackluster performance of the last 2 weeks. But I thought it was a great race, Rich.
It certainly was. As you say, Jim, really, it was a race of the first few laps and then the last few laps, really, wasn't it? I mean, as soon as Alonso got to the front with probably 6 or 7 laps to go, he really put the hammer down and the pace picked up big time. So, yeah, I mean, he really meant business this time. You could tell that he wanted a bit of revenge for what happened last time out when he did get kind of punted out of the way. And I mean, he didn't even finish on the podium, which is very unusual for him, because let's not forget, after this weekend's result, having won, I think he's now only one race off being the winningest, which is not a term I like very much, but winningest Moto3 rider of all time. He will overtake Fanati, who, of course, was in Moto3 for four
years.
Or five times length of time that Alonso's been in there. So, I mean, it's an amazing record that he's got.
Is he going to win single season? Will he have the most wins in a season? Too right, he's close to
I
that.
Wouldn't
isn't
be
he?
Surprised. I, would
I think
not
he
be
is.
At all
I think
surprised.
He's real close. He needs one or two more, probably, because this.
Yeah,
I think this was his eighth win of the season.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
and it's
phenomenal.
Still a lot of races to go as well. So I mean,
yeah, it's very
and
possible.
You won't rule him out winning a handful more.
No,
so
no.
It was a cracking last lap. Very tense. Very exciting. I got to say, I'm impressed with Danny Holgado. I mean, he's not winning races still, but he's certainly taken on board the, in good measure, the criticism that he got from his boss, Hervé Poncharal, who was quite critical about the fact that he wasn't being aggressive enough. So he, you know, fair play to him, credit where it's due. He is certainly mixing it right up the front. But again, Jim, and I keep saying it every race, like a broken record, I just can't get over how clean the racing is and how few crashes there have been this year in the races. I don't think, maybe one or two people at the back early on, but certainly in terms of the top 10, for Asato's ambitious punt on Fernandez aside, which didn't result in a crash, nobody went down. And that's been the case pretty much all season long. So it's an unusual kind of trait of Moto3 this year, whereas you're used to seeing, certainly on the last lap, you know, some hair-raising manoeuvres of people panicking and trying to get the job done and high-siding or taking somebody else out. You know, we just haven't seen any of that this year. It's really impressive, really.
Yeah, I agree. A couple little things for me here. Alonso won the race with the track limits warning. The kid could have easily slid across anywhere, and he didn't.
Nerves of steel.
It was, I mean, I'm not saying that he was not fazed by it. considering, you know, what Martin had said, hey, I was distracted by seeing a, you know, lot track limits warning on my dash or whatever. The other one, I'll give all credit, as you said, to Holgado, and so I think we'll leave that there. But I thought Piqueras had another great race. He's on the Honda, and he made it look easy to be there. And so, and to some extent, for Sato as well. I mean, for Sato, probably would have been in it with a shout. He just hasn't learned how to calm down yet.
Yes,
So,
exactly.
again, why he ever decided to punt? They weren't getting away. Nobody was getting away. That pass on Fernandez could have came a lap later, 2 laps later. It really didn't matter, which I thought was a bit of immaturity on first audio, but it will happen. I think he'll win a race before it's over. So, but let's look at the championship standings as it stands right now. You give Alonso another 25 points. That puts him 271 points. He is 82 points ahead of Holgado, but Helgardo is level even with Vire at 82 points behind Alonso as well. So they're tied essentially for it. But I think Helgardo's got what, more podiums? Because I think the tiebreaker is wins and then podium finishes. So he must have. I know Helgardo hasn't won yet this year, and I don't think Vire has either. So it's got to be podiums that is making the difference there in the standings. Then it's Artola, Piqueras, Munoz, Rueda, Kelso with a pretty decent ride. Again, he seems to lose at the end of the race for some reason. Then Adrian Fernandez and Yamanaka are your top 10 there. A great, great Moto3 race. It's why we watch Moto3. It's why we love Moto3. And, again, another shout out to Pirelli because there's not as many crashes. Now, that doesn't mean it's all Dunlap's fault. Don't misinterpret that statement. It just seems as though that these little bikes seem to gel with the Pirelli tires in a way that, maybe perhaps Dunlap didn't. And it doesn't mean the tire wasn't fine. It's a different type of tire. And these kids obviously have taken to it pretty well because the racing this year, I think, has been absolutely phenomenal because no one has gotten away from anybody at all. It's been tight races. I mean, even on the tracks we would expect someone to get away, it really hasn't happened. So.
And the other point that's worth making, if you think of Piqueras last time out,
Yes.
I mean he had to ride hard through the field and make up some gaps as well. So
Oh,
you
yeah.
can punish these tires in the way that it was harder to do, I think, with the Dunlops. You could easily burn them out. I mean, okay, you saw Acosta do it in Qatar, where he started in the bloody pit lane and won the race there, if you recall that first race that he took. You cannot ignore that correlation between lack of crashes, great racing, and a new tire coming onto the scene. I mean, that it has to be linked. So, good point, Jim. I hadn't necessarily made the connection with the tires and the fact there were less crashes, but there's more grip, clearly more grip and more feel.
Yeah, because they're setting lap records everywhere. So,
But still
yeah.
very impressive given how
Oh,
relatively young
yeah.
and inexperienced a lot of these
These kids
kids are
are.
on the world level. So, yeah, no,
Yeah.
fantastic race.
I mean, are they really that far off? Because a lot of these kids are junior world champions. They are Red Bull rookies champions. I
True, but they're
mean,
still very, very young.
they're still young. I'm not gonna lie there. They're still very young, but I think the level of what these kids are now is a lot higher than what it was when we were in our 20s, kind of a thing.
Without a
There's
doubt,
mature,
without a
there's
doubt.
another level of maturity. And I think a portion of that has to go to Red Bull and their Rookies Cup and the mentoring that these kids are getting, the identifying these kids at an early age and helping to mentor them through is probably a lot of it as well. So, I mean, it hasn't been without problems because we know there's been tragedy just not too many years ago. It was like, whoa, we gotta do something here. And we have changed the age limits for the class. But either way, still fantastic racing. And we'll move from there to Moto 2. Now, Moto 2 in the first qualifying session, Marrero's there, Guevara's there, Aegis is there, Alcoba, Anshu, and Bender. Van de Gerberg and Lopez is kind of there. That's sort of maybe the oddball that Lopez was there. Given that he's Audiger's teammate, you just didn't expect to see him really there in Q2. He was. Van de Gerberg, Foggia, Senna, Aegis, Lopez all get through to get to that second qualifying session. Now, halfway through the second qualifying session, Arbolino is quick on the Mark VDS bike. He seems to have the capability now to qualify on the Pirelli that he sort of couldn't do previously. He's gone back to either some setting or found something or has got himself a setup that works for him and how he wants to ride the bike with that with those tires. Kennett was second quick. Dixon was third. Then Alonso, Van de Gerberg, and Foggia. Agüero was seventh. He was very far down the pack. Garcia was 14th. Well, at least he wasn't in Q1. Let's let's give him some credit there. You know, we're slowly moving ourselves forward. But Roberts was 16th. And then Chantra fell at turn nine. And then Roberts from absolutely nowhere, with literally just barely seconds left on the clock, but maybe 30 seconds, 20 seconds left on the clock, went to the top of the heap with a lap that I did not see that coming from anywhere, because Roberts had not made a lap at all in the first half of the session. He never left the pits. He had not set a time. He did that on a one flying lap and he went to the top. Now, Arbolino did get by and Roberts fell, or sorry, not Arbolino, Kennett got by at the end. And he did take pole away from Joe. But that was still a great moment for Joe. I was shocked. I just didn't see it happening. But the starting grid was Kennett, Roberts, Arbolino. So instead of having a pole, which Tony the Tiger probably deserved, he was at least starting on the front row. Vietti would take the hold of the second row with Dixon in the middle, and then Audiger kind of right there, like, ooh, this is different from last weekend, which we never really talked about. The last time the racing was kind of, I don't want to say predictable or whatever, but this has had, usually we've seen before, like in the COVID era, if they raced at a track previously, then came back to it, it sort of repeated itself to some extent. This was completely different. Like the grids were all shooken up and different things, which was kind of nice to see. I don't know if the rain washed away the rubber and that changed things and made it different or whatever it was. But then that was your top six. So that's where we were going to go as we went into the Moto2 race. Now, Arbolino got a heck of a hole shot, and Kennett and Roberts just leaned on each other as they were heading to turn one. As they get out of one, there's a bullet that goes flying by on the outside of everybody named Agüero. Now, Agüero had started seventh from qualifying. That was one of the best moves at the start of a race I think I've ever seen happen because it was so quick, so fast, and so unexpected. But he was starting, as you're looking down the main straight, he was starting to rider's left. So he was able to cut the corner early. It just roared past her. I really didn't think when I first saw it, I thought Agüero had missed his brake marker and was going to trash it going into two. Like, I just didn't think it was possible for him to hold on to it. It was that stunning of a moment, because, and your attention was taken away from what he was doing, because Roberts and Canada are just banging off of each other, elbows out, and you're waiting for those two guys to hook a bar and fall off. So your attention isn't even anywhere near Agüero. And then Agüero just goes boom, right up to like third place. It's like, whoa, that's just crazy. And so it was like, kind of like a foreshadower of things to come in this race. Because it was like, whoa, that was not expected in a Moto2 race or whatever. But it settles down a little bit to where it's Arbolino, Vietti, and Kennett. Those guys are sort of settled into the lead. Now, Garcia crashes at turn one. Dixon also had a crash at turn two, but he remounted. They were both trying. Like, it happened at the same time. Like, Garcia crashed at turn one, then Dixon made it one corner farther and fell off too. And both of those guys tried to remount. Now, basically, Arbolino, Vietti, and Kennett are out front. Nobody's near them. Those three guys are going to, one of the three guys is going to win the race. And Tony the Tiger does, like, the donkey work. He's leading like almost every lap that there is. Eventually, we see that like Vietti had like a serious rear end snap, and Kennett would get by him because Again, it's unbelievable that Vietti connect. Wow, going to that last turn, Vietti had one of the wildest bucking Bronco moments I've seen in a long time. And he caught it. I was like, whoa, there must be some severe tire issues with Vietti, because it looked to me like the rear had let go and then it gripped and pushed the front, and then the front tucked and he pulled it back. And then it's this oscillation of front grip, no rear grip, front grip, rear, front grip, rear grip, front grip, rear. And he eventually just rides the thing off. But by the time he got it all collected back together again, he had lost. It was in third place. So it looked as though that the race was going to be Kinect against Arbolino for who was going to win. But Arbolino was running an absolutely fantastic race. We got down to basically like the last three laps of this race, and these guys are absolutely going at it. But Kinect and Arbolino are right there. And what's weird about Kinect, he's never really made a place on anybody unless somebody made a mistake, because Arbolino goes wide, Kinect goes to the lead, Vietti's off the pace, if you will. His moment that he had trying to wrestle up the bunking Bronco had put him like what, 4 or 5 tenths behind the two guys out front. Figured Vietti's got a sure podium. That's it. They get on to the last lap and Arbolino's leading. And all you're thinking is Arbolino's going to win one finally. He's finally got the Pirellis figured out because his late race pace was wicked. And he's rolling around this place. And all he's got to do is not make a mistake. Do not make a mistake. And Kinect is not going to get by you. And it looked like he had this covered until we got to the last two turns and Arbolino outbraked himself big time. So he, yes, sir.
I think he was having gear selection problems, because if you watch the replay, and he did it on, or it happened on lap 19 as well, where he lost a bunch of time in the same corner on that hairpin at the end of the very sort of long back straight, you could see him fishing on the gear lever trying to get it into gear, and it just, just cost him that little bit and sent him out wide. But that was, game changer really, wasn't it? Because on the last lap, there's no way to recover that.
You're right. I do think he was having gearbox problems. Initially, I thought he just outbraked himself, but
It
you
looked
are
like that.
you're it looked like it, but you're correct. I believe what you're saying, because that probably fits the scenario a little better than Arbolino just simply outbraking himself. Because I never really thought about it that way. So well spotted, Rich. Well spotted. But Arbolino's wide. That allows Canet to get in front. And all of a sudden, out of magical, here's Vietti, who gets Arbolino as they're heading to the last turn. So this is Canet's race. And then everybody's sort of decided that Canet is going to win this thing. I was like, wow, he's going to have a second win. Except for Vietti had some different magical power of some kind that allowed him to rail around the outside of the last turn and literally just beat Kinect in a drag race to the finish line. And Vietti wins the race over Kinect and over Arbolino. It was the wildest Moto2 race since the inception of the class in those early couple of years. But there could be one of those races that might have been like a little bit better when the class first went four stroke, but this race was spectacular. It's easily in the top three of great finishes of a Moto Jeep of a Moto of a Moto 2 race.
Yeah,
Fantastic finish, Rich.
certainly the wildest last half a lap of a race ever
Oh,
in Moto2.
easily,
Yeah.
easily. Absolutely
I mean,
insane.
as you say, I mean, you had two people that you thought were dead certs for the win, and the guy you thought was completely out of it a few laps prior won the race. I mean, that doesn't happen very
No.
often. I mean, poor old Canet. I mean, you have to feel for him, but he was understandably so defensive and tight going into that final turn that Vietti just pulled a masterstroke, didn't he? Because he just ran the berm around the outside and just gassed it, a bit like Aguirre had done in turn one, actually. He just squared the corner and just let the torque do the rest. And Canet, was leant over longer, a bit slower coming off the turn, and that was just enough that, I mean, I'm not quite sure what the winning margin was in the engine, but it was probably a couple of thousandths,
Let
something like that,
me.
because it was very, very, very close. So, yeah, I mean, thank God Canet has won a race already, because that would have been a hard one to take if that had robbed him of his first victory. So at least that didn't happen. But he must be pretty tired of finishing second.
So the official time difference between Vietti and Canet is 29 thousandths of a second, 29 milliseconds.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was
doesn't
crazy.
Get a lot closer than that. Yeah.
No. It was a great race. It was a fantastic Moto2 race. It was like you had to stick with it because the middle of the race was boring. Nothing's happening. They're just burning off laps, but the last four are so worth the wait to get to that. Oh, yes. Good grief. Iger scored big because he came home fourth. Audiger had a decent race to be fifth. I mean, we didn't see any of this because for some reason they were fixated on the front.
Yeah.
In the middle of the race, I'm like, there had to be good racing happening in the back, but nobody seemed to care. It's like, well, okay, we're just going to sit here and watch these guys roll around. Like, why are we doing that?
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad we did because it told the story all the way through. But anyway, Audiger fifth, Joe Roberts would finish sixth. Aegis was seventh. Then Ramirez, Lopez, Slatch fill out the top 10. Then Gonzalez, Foggia, Guevara, Chantra, and Alcoa get the last points of it, which was, again, this is the crazy race. In the championships, Iagura is on 188 points. That puts him 22 clear of Garcia. Roberts is on 143. He's 45 back now. Lopez, then Audiger, then Canet, then Dixon. Vietti's eighth. Gonzalez, and then Arbolino is in the top 10 for points. Looks like I's got at least one hand on the trophy. I mean, you know, it's only 22 points. A lot can happen, but he seems to be the more consistent of everybody who is around him right now.
Yeah, he's kind of what I would say is he's asserting himself now.
Well said.
He's going probably, I would venture into a phase of the season now that is slightly going to favour him. I don't know why I feel that. I just kind of always think of him as very consistent and a strong finisher, both in races and in championships in recent years. The only problem he has is he is liable to the odd crash and he does injure himself. You know, if you remember a couple of years ago, he kind of lost the championship because he broke his wrist towards the end and that really hampered his title run that year. So, you know, hopefully nothing like that's going to intervene and mess things up for him. But, I mean, Garcia's still only 22 behind. I mean, it's not a huge, great big gap. So, you know, if Garcia can start to find some of that form that he's had for most of the season, then, you know, there's still a championship fight to be had here. But if he keeps kind of just turning in these slidey sort of performances, going further back in the points or sliding off as he did this time, then I can't really see, you know, a Roberts or a Lopez, and certainly not an Aldegar at this stage. I find that a bit of a leap to see them closing that size of a gap with Aguirre being as good as he is. So yeah, I think you're right, Jim. I think he's kind of got half a pinky on the title. I mean, it's not quite there yet, but he certainly, yeah, is asserting himself now.
Two fingers.
Yeah, couple of fingers, maybe.
I say a couple fingers, but hey. Yeah. Oh, that was a great race. And then the only thing we had left was MotoGP. So if we look at what went down in the qualifying, in the first qualifying session, Miller is there. So is Zarco. His teammate Binder is there as well. And Alex Marquez and Oliveira. Now, Rins had a stomach bug or was feeling ill. This guy is like the modern day Kevin Schwantz. Can't seem to catch a break anywhere. Apart from a broken leg.
You can catch that sort of break.
Yeah.
shouldn't laugh. Broad Alex.
No. But Alesia was down at like turn one at the front, on the throttle. At halfway, Oliveira and Mir were the quickest people there. Mir had probably his best weekend on the Honda of this year. I don't know if they found anything, but he a lot of time was the fastest Honda, which is saying something. It wasn't Zarco. Trackhouse made it a 1-2 for a little bit until Binder spoiled the party because Raul and Oliveira were both there on top with about 2 minutes to play. But like I said, Binder had stole the show. But then Augusto was down at turn three, lost the front. But Binder and Oliveira get into the second session, right? The second section, Marquez would start on the bike that he did not crash in free practice. So, but it was available to him. We knew that. So, but it didn't seem to matter because he crashed that bike because he wound himself into the gravel. And Marquez is pushing a I get Honda flashbacks. He's pushing a bike that's not capable of being at the front harder than it needs to be. I was like, dude, you got the factory bike. Could you just chill and save this for next year, please? Yeah, you know, it's my words to Mark. Mark, if you listen, I know you do. Take it easy, pal. Next year, okay? Oh, so anyway, basically, Bagnaia would take pole, followed by Martin and Bastianini. So Ducati's across the front row. Binder with a great show right at the end to grab the fourth spot. Then Acosta, Bezzecchi, Marc Marquez would be seventh because he fell down the order, having not been able to go back out again. And funny enough, he went out, was going to go onto the bike. He walked out, said, nah, put it back in. Then he went back out later on. And I don't know what his planner was. I don't know if he wanted to try to catch on to the fast guys and get a tow or, but
Yeah,
that
I
didn't
think
seem to work
so.
because you're going out on a tire that was definitely not going to be cold. It's strange what he did. I'm not sure. Didn't understand that strategy at all. So that
It
was
has
it.
been his MO for seasons long though, hasn't it, Jim? Is to go out and catch a tow off people, or a reference probably is the better term. So yeah, it's the one aspect of his qualifying behavior that I'm always a bit surprised about, really, because he's so quick, but
But
he
he
seems
only.
to like it having somebody to chase, doesn't he?
Yeah, but he only ever did it when he was on a bike that wasn't quick enough.
Well, he's been doing it a lot this year.
Right. And his bike
Noticed
is not
it.
quick enough.
Yeah,
The
well, he's on slightly
year-old
inferior
Ducati.
equipment, slightly inferior. He's still on a Ducati, but
Well, he's on an early spec 23.
yeah.
It's not even a late spec 23.
But he's
So,
not on a
well,
Honda, so
but it's
you
not,
know.
yeah, thank God it's not a Honda. But I mean,
Yeah.
when he had the power of Honda and they were winning everything, he'd go out and just throw a lap down. It looked like Casey Stoner out of the pits. Wham, guys, go chase that. And he was good. I mean, I don't know. He used to qualify well. He doesn't now. He's becoming the enigma there. But I'm going to be interested to see how that happens when he's got a 25
Yeah.
Ducati. Things may change.
Yeah,
Anyway,
I agree.
we'll move our way to the sprint race. Martin had the whole shot. Binder was there next. Then it was Bagnaia. Then it was Marc Marquez. And then it was Acosta. Binder basically fell, whatnot. Martin was like, 7 tenths clear early on. Acosta would get by Binder. Then it was Martin, Bagnaia, and Bastianini. So they're going for it. With about six to go, the fight was on. Martin got a track limits. He then blinked first because he seen the track limits warning. It upset him. That allowed Bagnaia to get by. It was all over at that point. Bagnaia wins the sprint, followed by Martin and Bastianini. Marquez would be fourth, then Acosta, Binder, Quartararo. Quartararo with an absolutely fantastic ride. I think Quartararo had a great weekend all the way around. He's really right. The main, it's such a difference between how Marquez dealt with the problems at Honda and how Quartararo deals with the problems at Yamaha. He rides within himself to the point where I'm going to push this bike, but I'm not going beyond the limit of where I know I can safely be. It's a much different scenario, whereas the other guy wants to just fling that thing down the asphalt as many times because he's just either Quartararo is not dedicated to winning the way Marquez is dedicated to winning, or Quartararo has a more rational, sane thought that eventually I will get a bike that I can win and I'm still young enough that I don't have to do what Marquez is doing, kind of a philosophy.
I think I would just caveat that, Jim, by saying that the Yamaha has a demonstrably better front end on it than the Honda
Yeah,
has had
true.
for a long, 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 long time. So
What
there's not
Honda's
a
ever had a good
risk.
front end? Come on.
Well, yeah, you say that a lot, but you know, again, you know, we know the Yamaha is a sweet handling bike, so it's not prone to throwing its riders up the road. But Quartararo certainly is extracting everything and a bit more out of it at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. That's for sure. Either way, at the end of this, it's 321 to 317. Bagnaia has cut the lead to 4 points that Martin had going in. So I was like, okay, this is kind of becoming it's a Bagnaia weekend, right? So we get to the second race or the actual race. I mean, whichever way you want to look at it. We're on Sunday's event. How's that?
Yep, that'll do.
And Martin gets a hole shot, and then Bagnaia got to the front. Bastianini was right behind him. It's Binder and Acosta and Bezzecchi and Mark Marquez. Then Marquez gets by Bezzecchi. Binder crashes at turn four. And the top three had an 8-tenths of a gap already, just a lap and a half in. They were 8-tenths ahead. So, okay, this race is going to come down to Bagnaia versus Martin versus Bastianini. And that's kind of where this thing runs out. Because, you know, basically, Martin would get by Bagnaia at turn eight. And we noticed that sort of Bagnaia's rear is like really snappy. And the pace that they were running out front was super slow. Now, I never read anything that he about Bagnaia having a bad tire or a tire that didn't bed in right, or if there was any kind of a problem with the tire. Did you read anything that would tell us different? Okay.
Yeah,
what did you see? Or what was you told?
He was, well, I won't say complaining vociferously, because I wasn't in the media debrief, obviously, because I wasn't there, but the people that were said that he was just reporting that he had, certainly in that first five, six, seven, eight laps, no rear grip at all.
Yeah.
Absolutely none. And he was kind of insinuating or probably flat out saying, I had a bad tire. I mean, you do get a bad tire in a batch from time to time. You know, the tires are distributed around the teams randomly, so there's no kind of, you know, background sort of nefarious stuff going on. I mean, if we remember,
they're all hand-built tires.
Yeah, and it's, you know, Martin had that trouble last year in Qatar. He had a bad rear tire, and I think it genuinely was a rear tire problem, and it appears to be the case that that's what Bagnaia suffered from this time around. Although, just prior to him exiting the race, he did start to pump in fastest laps, so it looked as if the tire came back to him. But certainly up until that point, he said, and I heard it on a couple of the other podcasts from the people that were in the debrief sessions, you know, at the end of the day, he just had said he had no grip on the rear. So yeah, that was his problem. And you could clearly see that, as you say, Jim, visibly from the TV. And obviously he dropped back quite a long way in that early stage.
Yep, definitely. Because he'd fallen to third because Bastianini, the beast, had just gotten by. So Martin and Bastianini were clearing off. And there was, okay, no grip on his tire. One thing of note is like around lap 23, there was a great shot of Acosta coming off the last turn. Did you notice how fast the rear ride height device dropped the back into his bike? It was noticeably quicker than any other motorcycle that came out of that turn. The Ducatis will squat, but it's a very linear, very, and they, you know, they're down. This is like somebody just simply let all the air out of that back end and just went, whoop. It was like within a second, that thing was dragster mode. Yeah. It was crazy that it worked like that. It was one of the greatest shots I've seen of watching the rear end of the motorcycles collapse the way they do in the shape shifting era that we're in. It was just amazing that, you know, KTM's device, rear ride height device, works so much faster than everybody else's. Or they're able to tune it that way, and that's just what Acosta wants. take your pick, you know. I mean,
and it might be that he's just deploying it a little bit earlier off the turns as well. So, you know, under that bit more lean and acceleration, it's just forcing itself down even more. But Jim, I know I keep saying it, but God, I hate those shape-shifting devices.
I do too.
Oh, they make the bikes look so heinous. It's just, oh, it's a crime against everything I can think of. I can't wait for them to be gone. I really can't. And I know, you know, it's a prototype thing, and Alan will be tutting at me when he's listening to this, and, you know, everything goes. And I do get that, but aesthetically, they're just abominations, those things. They really are. And when you see them dropping down to at the speed that the KTM does, but all of these systems are highly developed now, obviously, after so many seasons of running them, and they're just vile, really vile. I can't wait for them to be gone.
Yeah, I can't wait for them to be gone. I can't wait for at least some modified aero, so it's just a couple of winglets, if you will, on the front. Anyway, let's get back to the racing. So at this point, it's Martin out front. You have Bastianini behind him. Bagnaia has fallen off, has fallen back because of his tire issues. Acosta crashes, trying to pick up the throttle on the front, maybe because he's picking up the throttle and deploying the rear ride height device at the same time, potentially. I don't know, but definitely the kid was down. there. Now, basically, the next few laps, suddenly Bagnaia winds up grabbing some pace. So, like, the tire came in or got good or finally heated up, whatever happened, happened. And he's the fastest guy on the track. He's catching Martini's catching Bastianini, except for the fact of it was that he wound up falling. Oops. I think hearing what was said here, because I didn't know the piece of the tire issue with him. I suspected it was a bad tire. I just didn't know it for certain because I watched the race. I didn't get a chance to do all the other stuff because I was gone over the weekend.
Yeah.
But at that point, when he went down, I felt like, okay, you were riding so hard to try to get to the front and win a race that I don't think you needed to win because there was plenty more races to come. Take the points. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not in his shoes, but I would have raced with my mind and said, well, third is the best I can do right now. We know Martin is liable to take some crazy tire choice at the island and not finish a race. There could be another one of these spotty rain events where, Martin makes the wrong call or pits too early or whatever. There's a lot that could happen in the races that are left. I don't think he had to really go for it because it's 25, 20, and 16, right? So that's 5 plus another 4, 9 points you're going to be down. You're only
Yes.
down 4. You'd be 13 going into the next round. That's nothing, especially with the sprints, to add into that list. So, was it an unforced error by Bagnaia? I say so. He really didn't have to make that mistake. Perhaps there might have been something with the bike that we don't know about. Maybe the tire went back off again and he didn't have the grip he wanted. But it was uncharacteristic of Bagnaia to throw things away like he did, especially later in the season. We've seen him do it at the beginning of the season, different races, but usually by the time we get to Misano, he's got himself sorted out and he's good to go. But although we did see Sepang in the very first year, he won his world championship, but there's always those chances. So either
He's
way.
always been a bit sort of topsy-turvy, hasn't he? Let's be
Yeah.
honest. I mean, he has crashed out a lot of races and a lot of sort of race leading positions, and he's done it a few times this year. Now, I mean, my take on this, Jim, just briefly, because I know we need to push along, but he got some grip. He set the fastest lap. So was he just pushing like hell to try and catch up in the vain hope, not vain hope, but in the hope that he would catch the two out front, who must have been, I think, what at this stage, what, 3 or 4 seconds up the road, I think. So not, drastically far away, but enough that he would have had to have pushed pretty hard. It was a weird crash. I mean, if you looked at it, the front just went with like no warning whatsoever. And I just wondered whether or not the way they sort of skipped the rear under the brakes going into turns like that, whether he just that tire was just suddenly delivering a lot more grip, and if it just upset the front as it sort of pattered a little bit, and it just kind of took the weight off the front momentarily, and down he went. I mean, there was no way he was going to save it. It was a very strange crash, really. I mean, you look at a crash like that and you think, oh, something's broken, but clearly it hadn't. It just caught him out. But it was just odd because he's so good at Misano, and that was obviously part of the reason why he was pushing like he was, because he didn't want to lose the home race, for that matter. So I don't hold it against him in a way. I think probably you're a bit more critical towards him than I feel. It was just an odd race that he found himself in, with the sort of the lack of the grip, and then the grip came and he wanted to push on. And yeah, but it's easy to be wise with hindsight, isn't it? But as you
Oh yeah.
say, perhaps, given how far away Bagnaia and sorry, Martin and Bastianini were at this point, I tend to agree with you. I think that was the day to bag the points and just move on.
The only
So,
reason I'm
yeah.
being as critical as I am of it is that that crash happened way early going into the corner. If he'd been at mid-corner picking the throttle up, I would go that, hey, the rear had more grip he wasn't used to, and that's what unloaded the front and he fell. That was all on the brakes. That was all him going way late when he didn't have to. He wasn't going to get there. So, hindsight's 2020 because we know what happens later on. So it wouldn't have been even as bad as it could have been
Yeah,
going into
yeah.
it, right? So again, I have too much old school American dirt tracker in me. because you raced like 36 races all summer long, and the guy who just consistently was near the podium or was in the top 10 had a great chance of winning those championships. Yeah, guys get on a run and put 4 or 5 race wins in a row down and whatnot. Yeah, I understand. But still, consistency was always a key. Take the points that you can get and live to race another day. And yeah. Just I'm like you. I'm 52. I'm set my ways. I'm always going to think that, and it just isn't going to change for me.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah.
But as we foreshadowed, there was drama left to be done. As we got down to it, Bastianini starts to really put a push on Martin. They go after each other a bit, right? And they're really starting to battle it up. By the last lap, we got down to what is that? The next to last turn. It's after all the fast. It was after all the fast rights. So I think that's like a 16, 15, like 14. At 14 or 14, Bastianini just puts a wicked move on Martin, forcing him off the track, running wide, basically. Martin's way wide because he got lifted up. Because even Bastianini didn't make the corner. You know, he was so deep and so late, he didn't make the corner. So both of them never made the corner at the apex. And then Bastianini goes on then to take the win. Martin throws up an arm in frustration and rides himself back onto the track and finishes slightly far behind it. This is the talking point of this race is Bastianini was not penalized, but we've seen people be penalized for that kind of discretion on the last lap. Do you think that move, considering the fact that Bastianini did not make the corner, was that a racing incident? Should he have been given a 3-second penalty? What do you say, Rich?
First of all, I think it was at turn 4.
Okay.
I was not getting the turns.
I thought it was all the fast rights. Anyway.
No, okay. it was in that first third.
Okay.
My initial gut reaction when I saw it was he's going to get a penalty for that. However, I watched the replays over and over and over again, and I think the devil's in the detail here. It wasn't even an investigation, which I thought that was quite odd, because normally these things flash up straight away, incident under investigation. But it was the last lap, so they had to make a quick call on this one, and they obviously just decided that they were going to take a certain direction. But that's created quite a lot of controversy, the fact that there was no case to be heard. My take, Jim, is that it was an okay pass, but like only just okay pass, because if you look at it on the various different angles, and particularly the replays, yeah, Bastianini throws one, but it's the last lap, and we know what these bikes are like. They're not easy to overtake. And particularly Misano is quite a tricky track anyway. So Bastianini throws it up the front. You're slightly distracted by the fact that Martin's doing his usual thing, and his leg's virtually straight out. So it kind of looks as if Bastianini runs into him, but he doesn't really. It's just that, you know, Martin's throwing his leg right out into the track, as most of them do. I don't think Bastianini touches Martin's bike, and he barely touches his leg, actually. I mean, there probably is a little bit of contact, but I don't think there's bike-on-bike contact. And I think that is crucial in terms of how the stewards took a quick look at it. In the second phase of that overtake, Martin re-leans into the corner and suddenly realises, actually, he can't do that. So he sits the bike up and he goes straight. So for me, he was at least partly to blame for the fact that he went off track as much as he did. Now, Bastianini, my initial thought was he'd run into Martin and he wouldn't have made the corner, but he didn't run into Martin, I don't think, and he did make the corner. He dropped off the curb onto the blue bit because he was looking around to see if Martin had hit the deck. I think that caused him to go over onto the blue bit. And again, the blue bit's crucial because that is not a track limits monitored corner. It's the green bits that are looked at for track limits. So he wouldn't have copped the last lap 3 seconds or drop a place penalty automatically as a result of that. And quite frankly, Martin did what Martin usually does, is he immediately sort of spits his toys or throws his toys out at the pram, starts gesticulating and stuff, and drops back and cruises over the last lap. So even if Bastianini had been given a 3-second penalty or whatever, Martin wouldn't have been in range to take advantage of it and get the win back. So it was a bit sort of handbags at dawn, really, although it calmed down on the cool down lap and they kind of pumped fists and stuff. And it was kind of okay in part of their May, although there was quite a bit of moaning and groaning, I think, again, in the debriefs later on. So I'm rambling. In summary, it was an audacious move. It was borderline, but I don't think he hit Martin, so I don't think he deserved a penalty for that. And yeah, you can argue that he didn't make the corner, but I think they realised that he looked behind him to check if Martin was okay. And so they probably just deemed that that was not a punishable offence either. And it wasn't a track limits corner anyway. So I think on balance, he didn't get a penalty. I think that was the correct call. But it's interesting how other riders have reacted now, because I think the key thing here is that race direction didn't even look at it. And so everybody's saying, well, if that's the kind of move I can throw on the last lap and, you know, there's going to be no case to answer, bring it on. So what unfolds over the course of the next few rounds is going to be, interesting. And it might create a bit of a legacy, which Simon Crafar inherits to manage next year, for one thing. The example, if you cast your mind back, Jim, you probably heard this and thought about it yourself, but an example that was brought to mind, which is a kind of a similar scenario, though it was on the first lap, I think, was Assen. I think it was in 2021 or 2022. Going into that tight hairpin at the first part of the Assen course, if you remember, Espargaró and Quartararo came together. It was actually Quartararo was deemed to be at fault, pushed Espargaró into the gravel. And if you remember, then Espargaró did that amazing comeback ride on the Aprilia and got Miller into the final chicane on the last lap for the podium. I think it was for the podium. Now, Quartararo was penalised for that incident because he was deemed to have thrown it up the inside, maybe sort of contact, but not very clear. And it kind of sent Espargaró off into the gravel on that occasion. He didn't crash, but that was penalised. And so there is this issue again of inconsistency. So that, I think, is probably the more pertinent thing that people might want to moan about rather than the call itself. It's just, again, inconsistent kind of application of the rules. So can I say one more thing before you give your bit? Because Lewis Duncan, who's a MotoGP journalist, he's now on, I think he's on crash.net now, made the very good point that part of the issue here is that the rule around this is quite poorly written and is very ambiguous in its meaning. And what it says, I'll just quickly read it because I wrote it down. It says, riders must ride in a responsible manner which does not cause danger to other competitors or participants or gain an unfair advantage either on the track or in the pit lane. Any infringement of this rule may be penalised by the FIM MotoGP stewards. Now, there's some issues in that rule because, and I've underlined responsible manner, well, that's open to interpretation straight away. Unfair, again, what does that contain in terms of what do you deem fair or unfair? And any infringement of the rule may be penalised, not will be, maybe. So, you know, it's open to a lot of interpretation. Now, okay, the stewards need some latitude, but at the end of the day, what the stewards say is what goes. So, you know, it's a bit baggy that, and that needs to be tightened up to define what kind of incidents are unfair, specifically, you know, under what circumstances. So I think it's been blown all out of proportion, and we're already talking about, or I'm talking about it for 5 minutes straight, if not longer, so I need to shut up. But for something that I think was okay, it's kind of become a huge, great big talking point, but it is going to have ramifications now that the riders are saying, okay, well, I can push moves like that out onto my competitors and I'll get away with it, which may well prove not to be the case because the stewards don't consistently rule on these things because of baggy rules like that. Okay, that's me.
I'm 100% with you. My only take is this. I agree. Bastianini did not touch Martin. However, in my opinion, from what I saw, how I looked at it, Bastianini wasn't going to make the corner regardless. Even though he's looking over at Martin or whatever, that's just a natural reflex because he thought he may have hit him. He felt Martin's leg and decided that, oh, maybe Martin went down. I don't think he could have made the corner on any kind of conventional racing line. Now, that doesn't mean he should get a penalty for it. I'm just saying that's the difference that I see to my eye and from what I know of me having, you know, been on the track with other guys in situations, sort of something similar to this, right? From there, it's like, okay, if you wanted to assess the penalty, it should have been under review immediately. And then I was kind of hoping that they would throw a 3-second penalty on him because Martin moped around just to like let Bastianini win. And yeah, you could have won if you would have got your act together, boy, as a sort of a smack in the face to Martin, like, hey, throwing your arm up and handbags at dawn is not how we ride here. It's kind of petty and childish. I tried to put it together, got pettish. I'm making up words again. Jacob.
Gym anyway, language.
Language, yes. So that's my take there on that one. The bigger problem is going to be what this has caused, because this has happened in other series too, where people go, wait a minute, is that the definition of what's okay? Because if that's the definition of what's okay, I'm going to chuck my race car up the inside of you next time, or I'm going to chuck a motorcycle up the side of you. The worst thing you could do is give Marquez any kind of ammunition to chuck your motorcycle up the inside of anybody, you know, because then he's got a defendable action. Like, look, this is here. You know, you can walk in with your iPhone, show him the YouTube video and go, guys, you said this is okay, which that is a slope we do not want to be on whatsoever. So I personally think that it should have been a stewards inquiry. Okay. That quickly would have gone to no further action, racing incident. And I think everyone would have been a whole lot calmer about this if they had at least done that. If I'm Simon Crafar next year and I see in a situation that is exactly similar to that, I am at least going to throw down that is under an investigation. And as you properly said, he never truly hit Martin's bike. They didn't make contact. He felt his leg there. And as you said, Martin's leg's the farthest out of anybody's, which I have a whole big thing about the leg dangle that Rossi started. It was straight down and I understand why he did it, but Martin, everybody else kind of throw it out there it's a way to block somebody or something. And I'm like, okay, guys, if you want to dangle your leg straight up, that's a whole nother side story. But my point is, if you're dangling your leg straight down, it's not out parallel to the racetrack surface. Okay. And so that's my take. That's how I saw it. And, you know, guys, write in and tell us what you think about it, because that's where we are with this one. With all of that said and done, Rich, Bastianini won, Martin second, Marquez got the podium because of all the other stuff that happened along the way. Then it was Bezzecchi, Morbidelli, Vinales. He didn't ride. He didn't break his bike. He rode it around, got a sixth place. So Gary's got to be absolutely excited. Now he's maturing even more that he's now finishing in the points. love you, Gary. I'm still laughing about that. Every time I think about it, I laugh. And then you had a Quartararo with another seventh place, which I think was fantastic. And then Espargaro, Alex Marquez, Oliveira, Mir got points on the Honda. Marini got points on the Honda. Even Zarco got points on the Honda, which was some of it was attrition there. But, you know, the Hondas actually looked halfway decent for once. And then with that, we'll look at the championship standings. So Martin is on 341 points to Bagnaia's 317. It's a 24-point lead. Again, if Bagnaia had just rode to third, it would not be a 24-point lead. Now, he had 24 coming into this weekend. It was 23 that Martin led by coming into the weekend. This is not insurmountable by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just thinking, where would you be if you would have calmed yourself down a little bit and just carried on? So, anyway, those two guys are going to settle this championship. I mean, Bastianini's on the outside looking in, and so is Marquez, but third, it's a two-horse race, and it's going absolutely positively well down to the very last race of the year in Valencia. That's where it's headed. It's been headed there since we started racing, quite honestly. So that's everything I can think of for this episode, Rich. Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
Just one thing that you probably missed because you were out watching other racing. Quartararo should have finished fifth, but he ran out of fuel off the last turn. So he finished seventh. Hmm. Yeah, they just, you know, just use a bit more fuel than expected during the race. Not as if he was underfilled, but yeah, no, he just ran out of juice. and so he dropped two positions, which was really frustrating for him because he had, they say, I mean, seventh is still a great result considering where they've been, but yeah, it was a fifth really. So a bit unfortunate, but yeah, that was just a little detail that also happened. And a lot of this stuff was lost because, again, it was another race where they really only watched what was going on at the front of the race. And you're thinking, surely there must be something else going on that we could look at. But anyway, that's good old race direction again.
Well, that's how it goes. All with all that, considering we've got one this weekend in Indonesia, followed by another one in Japan right after that, we're going to get out of here. I'm going to tell you to ride safe.
Yeah, and we'll see you next week.